You're listening to the Agony Column News Report, featuring interviews, phone interviews, reports from live book events and festivals, and conversations with readers. You can find additional news, interviews, book reviews, and more 5 days a week at the Agony Column website at trashotron.com/agony. Stephen Graham Jones is the author of books that include The Only Good Indians, My Heart is a Chainsaw, Don't Fear the Reaper, Night of the Mannequins. The capper to his Indian Lake trilogy is The Angel of Indian Lake. Thank you for joining me, Stephen.
Happy to be here. Thank you.
You know, when I think about the trilogies that I've read, you know, that format looms very large, especially in the genre fiction world. And I wonder if, when you were writing these books, did you feel the pull of the Platonic ideal of a trilogy helping you to write what was happening in these three books?
You know, when I was doing Don't Fear the Reaper, I did look to Empire Strikes Back and both the movie and novel version of The Two Towers. And they were really, really instrumental in letting me get the tone right. But there, as far as like other trilogies that I was trying to, like, setting a standard that I was trying to hold myself to, for sure. Like there's Philip Pullman's, his Dark Materials trilogy. There's Catherine Arden's Winter Night trilogy. And it's soon to be released, the third book, Rebecca Roanhorse's Between Earth and Sky trilogy. Which I've read the third one. It's amazing. They were all guiding lights for me, for sure, when I was in the darkness of three installments, you know, and they taught me how to kind of both, you have to surprise people in the third installment, but you also have to tie up threads at the same time. So you can't be opening new doors. You got to be closing. And they taught me a lot. Yeah.
You know, one of the things I was thinking about as I read these three books was that, in a sense, the three of them form like a Bildungsroman. It's a coming of age story of a young woman, and I thought that was a very interesting way to do it.
Thank you. Yeah, no, it is. It tracks Jade for 8 years of her life, you know, and not just 8 years, but eight formative years, when she goes from like 17 to her mid-20s, you know. And like, when you're 17, you think you've got it all figured out. You're going to be this person forever. You've reached the zenith, you know, like I like this music and, you know, I like to wear my hair this way and stuff. But then 3 years later, 4 years later, you're like, why was I so stupid? You know, and that's what Jade's going through, you know, like in Chainsaw, she was made of slash retrievia. In Reaper, she still has that inside her, but she's trying to suppress it, you know? And then in Angel of Indian Lake, she's like, don't pull me back into it. I'm done with this. I've already been through it twice, you know? But yeah, she does. You're right. She does mature as a person and hopefully get somewhere. That's what I want for her, you know?
Well, it's wonderful the way you create this character, and especially in this book, I have to say your prose was just wonderful. It was.
Thank you.
As I read the book, I kind of feel like, am I microdosing? It's very, very kind of a hallucinatory feel, and I'm wondering, as a writer, does that stuff just flow from the tip of your pen?
Mostly it does, yeah. And I mean, I'm so lucky to be working with Jay Daniels, because I feel like when I'm doing first person from her point of view, as is Angel of Indian Lake, I feel like she just kind of takes the pen and scoots me out of the way, you know, and just takes over and does it herself. She's got so much voice, you know, that if I were to try to suppress her, I think that would mess things up. So I just have to let her go. But like in a larger sense, what you're talking about, you know, I mean, that's wonderful if a narrative can feel like you're microdosing, I think, because every novel, every story is kind of like a sustained dream, you know, and every once in a while, a writer, a novel, a story can stumble into that space, and the reader and the writer kind of meet each other in that sustained dream area. And hopefully, if this trilogy does anything even approaching that, I'm thrilled, you know.
I love that she said you like working with Jay Daniels. It's like mm-hmm. she's an actress you're working with, and I think that to a certain extent, you know, the method acting is in a way what writers do and what you do so superbly mm-hmm. in these books.
No, I completely agree. That's the only way I know to write is to, like, I call it method writing. You know, it's like I have to, like, parachute down into the scene, into, like, wherever Jade is. You know, she's in the sheriff's office, she's in Terra Nova. And once I get my feet on the ground in the story, I look around and I'm like, oh, that's over there. This is coming from me and I got to react this way. And I'm, what's it smell like? What's it sound like and everything? And if there's any other way to do it, I don't know what it is. Maybe there are writers who are like chess players. They're like above it all, like Leo Tolstoy. I feel like Leo Tolstoy was one of those, like, I'm playing chess with these characters, you know? I've never had that kind of, cerebral ability, I guess, you know, that kind of objectivity. I've never had that. I'm always standing there in my character's shoes. That's the only way I know to do it.
As we read this book, one of the things that I liked the most was that it feels like a very literary book. These three books are a literary accomplishment in the horror genre. In fact, because I don't think there's any other trilogy that stands out so much. There are series books, but that's a very different thing. The trilogy is this is a very singular statement across three novels.
No, you're right. Horror can't sustain series. Horror has a hard time with trilogies. And I mean, I think the reason horror has a hard time with trilogies is that everybody dies, you know? And so it's hard to have anybody left for continuity. Like when you have a series, then you've basically got a James Bond type character who is going to face a different set of circumstances every time. And they're the stable thing. And they're like, lack of development is kind of stability that allows the series to move forward. And but when you're doing a trilogy, you have to give the character an arc from book one to book three, and that's completely different than a series. And you're right, it is. There's not a lot of horror trilogies that I can think of either. What's that? There's that one. Is it the Blackwater trilogy? I think.
Right. Yeah. Michael McDonald, is it?
Yeah.
Friend, they had some nice screen press editions of those back in the day. One of the things that this book made me think is that horror really is dependent on history, and you use history in this book really well, and it's a really great exploration of history, not only the personal history of the characters, but also the cultural history that form the characters, that forms the backdrop, that informs all the places. I mean, Indian Lake itself is a piece of cultural history and not a happy one.
Yeah, you know, I never thought of it like that. I like that you see that, because I think that is there, actually. Because, the character, like Jade especially, like she sees her history as what kind of puts her out of the running to be a final girl, you know, and her kind of one of her surrogate fathers is a history teacher. And yeah, history, as Randy says about trilogies, it's what comes to bear on Angel of Indian Lake, the third installment, you know. And I learned a lot about history from writing these history teachers, because I had to read a whole lot of history stuff just to understand how they think, you know, like who do they revere, and like what's fact and what's just narrative. And I'm not saying I figured it all out. I don't think anybody's figured it all out, but it was fun to wrangle with, you know, and let me get into their headspace.
You know, you talked about researching history. Mm-hmm. One of the things that's wonderful about this book is that it incorporates so many different forms of narrative storytelling. There's the first-person sections from Jay, but there's also the reports from the people who are investigating her. And within those reports, there's letters from Jay and statements from other people. This is a wonderful way to tell history, and I think it really follows the story. It, in a sense, this is itself works with the history within the history format. The history of anything is the telling of many tales from different points of view, and you weave these together wonderfully. Talk about you. Doing that.
Yeah, no, thank you very much. I do think that the most compelling histories are an assemblage of, you know, first-person testimonials and recovered documents and eyewitness statements and all that kind of stuff. So I was trying to layer that all together to kind of provoke the reader into feeling like Proof Rock is real, you know, because to me, horror needs a baseline of the real so that we can understand what the eruption of the wrong is, you know? And so for me to make Proof Rock real, I had to like massage all these different ways of looking at it onto the page, you know, which was really, it was really fun and challenging. It was really challenging Chainsaw and Reaper, those essays that come between the longer chapters were super easy to write. They just like flowed out. These Baker investigation and, you know, reports were much trickier. It's much trickier for me to adopt that really formal limiting language. You know, it's not at all going to have any like blast offs of metaphor or figuration or anything. It's just the facts. It's like a dragnet kind of thing, you know? And I also had to be sure that the voice was different enough from the voice in the rest of the novel that you would know you were in this area, even if you missed the heading, you know?
Mm-hmm. One of the things that I found about with this book was that it manages something that would seem impossible. At one time, in one sentence, you will say things that are just hilariously funny, but also at the same time, deadly serious and have a lot of emotional resonance. For example, I pulled something out here. It's Jocelyn Cates. Her lips are firm. Her eyes hard. Her husband died in the winter water in 2015, and her son was suffocated with a dry cleaning bag in 2019. And now she's got a chainsaw. I mean, you get her history. it's hilarious. And it's also heartrending at the same time. And that happens constantly through this book. Mm-hmm. Talk about balancing those two on a knife edge.
You're right. And thank you for noticing that, first of all. But I think I think humor and kind of, it's like a dismissive sort of sardonic humor that Jade has built into her. And for her, it's a defense mechanism. It's how, like, if she doesn't laugh at the world, she's going to cry all the time, you know? And so therefore this is first person. It's all filtered through her. And so it's going to be tinged with her sardonic humor, you know, with her, hopefully never quite, I said dismissive. Jade is not dismissing these people, but she's trying to dismiss the violence, the terror, the scary stuff, such that she can keep moving forward, you know? And I feel like without humor, these novels would be just way too grim, you know? Sometimes I see scripts of my stuff that people have adapted, and it's always amazing. They fix the story up in ways I'd never guessed. But my one note is always, can we bring the jokes back, you know? Because I think humor and horror go hand in hand. You've got to have humor as a pressure release valve so the horror can reset, or else you get up to this screechy plateau and it just is flat and there's no rhythm, no variation. So I think horror and humor are locked together. They have the same mechanism. It's tension, release. And you don't know if you're going to laugh, you don't know if you're going to scream, but that's part of the essential pleasure of horror, I think, and specifically the slasher.
As a reader, one of the things I really look forward to is the chapter titles, because there are all different movies. They're the titles of various slasher movies, few of which I've actually heard of. And I would be, when I read the title, I'd look up the movie. And so I'm going through the book and I come to a title of one of the chapters is Bloodbath. So, okay, I'll look that one up. I looked that one up. And, you know, I can't find much about the movie because Bloodbath is in the news. somebody very important has used the word in a probably inappropriate manner. And I'm thinking, here in this particular instance, horror is doing its job as a warning kind of fiction. Horror stories are stories that are meant to scare you so that the kids will learn don't go out in the dark when you hear the wolves howling unless you want to get mm-hmm. eaten. So it's about horror as a warning fiction, and these stories in particular.
No, you're definitely right. Horror, like you can really, if you break horror down to its basic elements, you kind of end up at Little Red Riding Hood, you know, which is the cautionary tale there, or the cautionary urge from the parents to the child, basically, is stay on the path. It's safe on the path. If you stray from the path, that's where the danger lies. We want you to be safe. Stay on the path, you know, and so much horror. That's what it's telling us. It's telling us to stay on the path. And Bloodbath, that's, you know, an alternate title for Bay of Blood, you know. So when you search the titles of these chapters, a lot of them are going to be, I don't know how they're indexed in the databases of the various movie data sites, but if they make the alternate titles searchable, then some of these will come up, you know.
Well, they all came up for me, and
good.
And it's interesting because it gives as you read, you're reading an exciting piece of fiction, but you're researching parts of reality that are, you know, maybe somewhat important, mm-hmm. you know, especially given the time, you know. I think the original Bloodbath was made back in the 70s or maybe or something.
What did Bay of Blood? Yeah, Bay of Blood was like, what was it, 69, 70? Yeah. Right around there. You're right. Yeah.
So you're as you read this book, which is exciting and fun to read, you're also like getting a pretty good dose of history in addition to all the cultural stuff.
You're right. Like when I'm trying to make Proof Rock real for people, I have to describe like the rocky shore and the forest and the roads and all, but also what's palpably real for everybody in this story is the media landscape and the media landscape is made of all these slashers and horror films. And so, yeah, I do, like, I feel like to get the characters' feet on the media ground, I have to trek over to these titles and this trivia and stuff, you know, just to kind of like trigger those movies in their heads. And even if they don't know the movie, when you see like, I don't know, The Night Has a Thousand Screams, that puts you in a certain headspace, I think, you know?
Exactly. Yeah. Now, one of the things you mentioned that making Proof Rock real. And for me, the benchmark of a good book is if I can go back and visit the parts of that book as if they were like vacation memories. Uh-huh. And I can tell you, I have a better idea of what Proof Rock looks like than I do of some of my vacation memories.
Yeah.
So talk about, you know, what you're creating for readers here is not just a throughput of action, but also the memories of reading the books. So read the third book, we're thinking about the first two.
Mm-hmm. No, you're totally right. That's a good way to say it. You know, when I wrote Chainsaw, I didn't have like a map in my head of Proof Rock or Indian Lake. I didn't know what was east, what was west. You know, I would just say sunrise is over there, and I wouldn't think that's going to have implications later. But then when I got to writing Reaper, I had to go back and reread Chainsaw and kind of draw a map as I did so I could see how I've laid this town out, you know? So then in Don't Fear the Reaper, they're running all over the town, and I had to be able to know how far it is from the high school to the sheriff station, that kind of stuff. And but you're right. Then when I get to Angel of Indian Lake, I've already got that mental map in my head from Don't Fear the Reaper. And I feel like I was able to just really hit the ground running and not have to slow down to say, this is there, that's there and stuff. But you know, some of my favorite novels are novels that in my memory, like you're talking about, they feel more like experiences than things I've read, you know? Maybe it's just a result of people having lived in Proof Rock for three books for 1500 pages that does make it hopefully a little bit real to them. But I mean, that's the highest honor when somebody can remember your made up place is real. You know, it is real to me. Like I had to invest so much intellect and emotion into it to make it real enough for me to walk through and write about. But hopefully readers get some of that too. That's always my dream, you know.
One of the aspects of this book is that it carries a lot of cultural weight, mm-hmm. because of Jade is half Indian. Mm-hmm. The Indian Lake is over a village. A lot of the action, the historical action back that prefaces this story involves Indians and settlements.
Yeah.
I'd like you to talk about, you know, your enrolled Blackfoot, is it Blackfeet?
Blackfeet, yeah.
About the cultural influences working their way out in your fiction, just because Jade is although she's half Indian, it feels like she's an all final girl.
Oh yes, that's a good way to say it. I like that. But you know, coming up, what Chainsaw was the first novel I did after The Only Good Indians, and The Only Good Indians is set on the reservation, you know, up in Montana, and I could have wrote my next novel on the reservation. But I quickly realized, or I became fearful, I guess, that if I did that, I would be kind of, I don't know, positing the idea or the possibility that Indian stories are all locked to the reservation borders, you know? And then like a corollary of that would be that if you don't live on the reservation or have some, you know, really strong ties to the reservation, you therefore don't count as Indian. And of course, I want to push back against that. And so that's why I set Proof Rock. I didn't put Proof Rock up by the Blackfeet Reservation. I put it really far away in Idaho. And also, I cut any cultural ties Jade could possibly have to the Blackfeet. Her father is the only tie she could possibly have, and he's kind of malignant. So he's not considered a tie. I wanted to show that you can be Native, you can be Indigenous, you can be Indian without knowing the language, without knowing the history, without coming from your reservation. And with it, you can be Indian without tribal affiliation, even, I think, you know. I don't want to have an exclusive club because the part of having an exclusive club is gatekeepers who say you're Indian, you're not Indian, you can come inside, you have to stay out there in the cold, you know. And I don't think Jade would ever want to keep anybody out in the cold. She would be one of because she's been out in the cold. She would want to be accepting. And because I think she's a good role model to follow, that's also what I subscribe to. Yeah.
One of my favorite sets of characters in this book are the elk. Mm-hmm. And I think you use them really well. They're beautiful characters. Talk about integrating them into the narrative and making them more than just part of the landscape, but say something. And what they say is, as we read it, it's so much feeling. It's like notes of music as opposed to singing words.
Oh, that's a neat way to say it. Yeah, I did suffuse these three books with elk, you know, I mean, more than moose, more than deer, of course. But I think I'm just like fascinated. I've been my whole life, I've been compelled by elk, you know. I've been hunting them for years and years and years, and I respect them greatly. But I did like the motion that I kind of lucked into, like in Chainsaw. Jade and Letha hide in like a little mausoleum of dead elk, you know, like a big cavern made from the corpses of a little elk herd. And then in Angel of Indian Lake, Jade is also under tons of elk, but these elk are flowing past her, they're running past her, you know. And I love that development going from live elk to dead elk to live elk, you know. I like the idea that the elk have kind of been resuscitated through this trilogy. That makes me happy, you know.
One of the things I thought about as I read this book, there are some just amazing set pieces and scenes. And there's one that's quite long, although it doesn't feel like it when you read it. But when you, after you get done with it, you realize, God, did I really read that many pages? I can't hardly believe it. And I thought about the kind of the style of writing these set pieces. Another set piece by another writer that I really liked that was quite long was one by Neal Stephenson in Rimdi, where it was really long, but you got the feeling that he had like really mapped it out precisely constructed and then ran it through, and he knew where he was going. In a sense, it was like a piece of classical music that had been Well, like Beethoven, you know, I guess it's Alfred Hitchcock. Once the script was written, the movie was done, as far as he was concerned. Mm-hmm. When I read this scene, all I could think of was the soundtrack to David Cronenberg's Existenz, which used mm-hmm. his usual Howard Shore doing those kind of ominous strings, mm-hmm. but playing over it was Ornette Coleman's saxophone going kind mm-hmm. of crazy. Mm-hmm. And that's what I thought, this is the writing equivalent of Ornette Coleman's saxophone for Naked Lunch, as it were.
Oh, Naked Lunch. Oh, nice. I like that comparison. That's quite an honor. That's August company to be in, of course. I love Existenz, you know, that's a crazy fun movie, you know? It's also really cool that you say, you're right, there is a really long set piece in here. And it was a lot longer. These long set pieces I write, like I just get it all, like I put like 80 pages down and then I tell myself, nobody's going to tolerate an 80 page chapter. So I have to somehow figure out what's vital and bring it down to 52 pages or something, you know? And it's hard. I leave a lot on the cutting room floor, but I think losing 10 or 15% of everything you write makes what remains that much more pungent and strong, you know?
It felt, that was another place where the microdosing seriously ramped up during that.
Yeah.
It felt very hallucinatory.
Yeah.
You know, one of the things that's interesting in this book, and it's, I think, a theme is the how important, you know, you can know everything there is to know about slasher films. You can be really skilled at you know, shooting, running, jumping, whatever. But no matter how skilled or knowledgeable you are, you always have to deal with luck. And so talk about the import of just raw luck, chance, where stuff you can't control and can't foresee.
You know,
putting that in a novel.
Yeah, you're totally right. I think that's probably just me kind of dramatizing the way I actually write, because anything of mine that turns out like readable or decent or that readers like, I never ascribe it to like my craft muscles or my learned technique or any of that. It's always, I feel like it's always luck, you know, but like, you know, like Michael Jordan says, the harder he works, the more he practices, the luckier he gets, you know? So you do have to just write a whole lot to keep being lucky. But yes, that uncertain, there's always got to be a level of uncertainty. Like Jade, yeah, she knows all the rules, knows everything, but that level, there is that level of that intrusion of chance, you know, everything does finally hinge on somebody shot a crossbow bolt at me and it misses me by an inch or it hits me in the throat. You know, one of the, like it's fundamentally random, you know, like your stature within the genre is not going to preserve you because the real world doesn't work like that. You can just have bad luck too, you know?
This is also a trilogy in a sense about how the West was won. And so I like to talk about that kind of, you know, the deep historical backdrop informs, you know, your writing in these books and probably others, I'm guessing.
Like how the West was won, to me, I always phrase it as how the West was stole, you know, how it was stolen away. But and it was bought with blood, you know, and it wasn't the people taking its blood. It was our blood who already lived here. But yes, you know, when I wrote My Heart is a Chainsaw with Terra Nova glittering across the lake and everything and being this Camelot, I was playing with like, what if I was trying to like redo the dynamic of Christopher Columbus stumbling upon America, basically. And then my editor, Joe Monti, he says, hey, this is a story about gentrification. And I realized that gentrification is just colonization on a neighborhood scale instead of like a continental scale, you know, or a cultural scale. And but yeah, every chance I get, I guess, in these three books, I am trying to bring that to the surface, but it's less, to me, it's less that I have like a series of check boxes and it's more that I have an axe to grind in me. And so every 10 or 12 pages, that axe finds a place to sharpen itself, you know, more and more.
The way you develop the characters in the novel is really interesting. And we have a character who Jade speaks to quite a bit, Mr. Holmes. This is a really interesting way to use a character who is no longer with us, who died in the previous novel. So talk about keeping Mr. Holmes alive through the way Jade talks to him.
Yeah, like when Jade is talking to Mr. Holmes, and whether in her narration or whether in emails or however she's doing it, she does it a variety of ways. That is, of course, to her way of keeping him present, you know, keeping the idea of him close, because she's not ready to let him go yet. She probably never will be. But when you do that, really, you're writing a diary. You're just using a weird form of address, you know. You're writing to yourself. You're getting your thoughts out on the page or out in the world or whatever it is. But I think for Jade, it's like her maintaining the idea that Mr. Holmes is, you know, here and she can speak to him. It's kind of her way of making herself a better person, because she feels like she's got to live up to his ideals a little bit, you know. And I think we all probably do that to some level, you know, whether, who knows if it's, you know, a former history teacher or a relative or a spiritual entity, whatever it is, we often feel like there's somebody there and we've got to do good because they're kind of in the orbit, you know, they're watching us in some sense.
I really enjoyed seeing Jade grow up, as it were, and especially in this third book, she's in a sense calmed down and realized that the angst that drove her through the first two books is not dislike of the town so much, or being upset about her upbringing or all the terrible things that have happened. What has been driving her is the how much she cares about the people around her, a sense of a compassion. And I love to see that, you know, the sense of violence and the kind of snark recast as, you know, compassion and caring. Although in a snarky horror movie manner.
You know, in this third book, Jade is finally starting to feel like she might be part of the community, I feel like. And she has spent two books and most of her life saying she hates Proof Rock, she hates Idaho, she hates all these people. They're all, because they've all treated her wrong. They've treated her like they treated Stacey Graves, you know, like a cat that's wild, that's feral in the streets. But I like that in Angel, she's starting to get a glimmer of belonging. You know, that's what's been missing her whole life, is that sense of belonging. And I feel like she's starting to find it a little bit, you know, and that's what she needs, I feel like.
In this novel, one of the things that I really enjoyed was the way that you would mix up supernatural menaces, serial killers, you know, real killers, people who are just flat out crazy. You never know what's going to bring on the death. But it's there. And so talk about, you know, kind of, I guess, crushing the genres, because the novel with a monster or supernatural menace is very different from a straight up slasher film.
No, you're definitely right. You know what I decided this in My Heart is a Chainsaw, actually, is that the slasher audience is so cued into the conventions and the formula and the genre that they kind of function like Vladimir Propp writing Morphology of the Folktale, where he reduces Russian folklore or just world folklore down to little traits and types. And so if you see a princess and a stranger in the opening of this, then the story's going to go this way. You can, from the first two or three movements, you can understand every step that's going to follow. And I love that. I think that's really powerful and great. But I also have to contend with, everybody's going to guess what's going on in a slasher, you know? And so the way in the first two books, I was able to, or in the first book specifically, I was the way I was trying to like short fuse the ability of the slasher audience to anticipate what's coming is I would mix, like you're talking about, two types of killers, which are two genres, you know? And if I could pull that rug out from under the slasher audience's feet, then they wouldn't know exactly what subset of slasher they're in. And therefore, hopefully, they couldn't anticipate what was coming, you know? And to varying degrees, I try to do that in the next two novels too, in Reaper and Angel.
The openings of these books are just wonderful, openings of horror movies, and it's really fun to read that. Talk about, the cross-pollinating movies and fiction. I mean, all of these books turn heavily on movies, but all of these books are in fact books, and they have all the virtues of books, which is mostly that, you let the reader in on be the director and the art set designer.
No, you're right. I mean, the prologues are really they're really fun to write in all three of these books. The third one was a little tricky to get right, but the trick with the slasher on the page, you know, and in a book is that the slasher grew up and found itself at the box office, you know, at the drive-in on 42nd Street. And therefore, most of its little techniques that it has built into itself are cinematic. And so therefore, when I am writing a slasher on the page and I don't actually have camera angles and, you know, the same kind of cuts between scenes and stuff, I have to do different things to crossbreed film or cinema and fiction, you know, and it's really fun to do. That's actually been a project of a whole lot of my books, is how to kind of hotwire those two things together, you know.
Do you write screenplays?
Yeah, I've written a lot of screenplays, and and I hang around with screenwriters, and I've worked with, you know, directors. I've been in writers' rooms. I've taught screenplays. I've been through a lot of screenplay training. I like the challenge of just this different form. Like, a lot of people think that writing a screenplay for a novelist is just about format, but it's not. It's a completely different way of building a story, you know? And once you kind of have that clickover moment where you're like, oh, it's not just a novel shoved into this shape, you know, it's a totally different way of telling a story. Once you kind of get a handle on that, I think you can do some work, you know. But at the same time, you know, I've played in Hollywood and I've decided that probably my home is the bookshelf. That's where I belong, because I love writing screenplays, as I was saying, but it seems like every Hollywood project is a comet out in, you know, out by Pluto, and it's trying to make its way to the sun, and it's got this big long icy tail because it's falling apart. And all through, every time it passes close to some gravitational body, another big chunk of itself calves, you know, calves off. And every great once in a while, like one speck will make it where it's going, but usually it falls apart before it gets where it's going, you know.
One of the things that this book constantly made me think was that, you do a great job of kind of inverting the power structure, where Jade, who's essentially a kind of, outcast girl, is the one who knows what's going on, really. And the one with all the power, and the sheriffs and everybody else has, like, and even the rich people, they think they have power, but they don't. So talk about inverting the power structure in these novels.
Yeah, that's a good way of putting it. You know, there's that old saw people talk about how the fun of a post-apocalyptic fantasy is that the CEO's talents and abilities no longer matter in this world. The person whose abilities and talents matter is a custodian, because they know how to do stuff, you know. And Jade is the custodian, and Prufrock has been through an apocalypse, that big massacre on the water, you know, in the first book. So there has been an inversion, you're right. And Jade's specific set of skills, like, you know, Liam Neeson and Taken, are turned out to be exactly what is needed, you know.
Talk about creating that voice and living with Jay Daniels for I'm not sure how many years that you yeah. have been.
It's been a few years. Jade was it's weird. Like sometimes you write a character for 50 pages and then you finally hit the lope of their voice. You understand how they put words together and how they stack clauses. But Jade was, from the first time she showed up, I think she showed up in 2018, if I'm not mistaken, then she just hit the ground running. Like in the draft that she showed up in, it was first person, and she told the first third of the novel, and Hardy told the second part, and Letha told the third part, and I gave it to people, and they said it was really fun when Jade was talking. It's not so fun when that sheriff or that other Letha starts talking. And so that told me that Jade, there's some mix of, I don't know, humor and, you know, I don't know, pathos, whatever it is, there's something to Jade, and it comes out in how she speaks or how she kind of orders her world through language, I guess. And so I wish I could talk about constructing Jade, but really I feel like I just discovered Jade, like I stumbled into her and she just was already talking, you know. I just had to like hold the microphone over to her and let her go. And then,
does she live with you when you're not writing?
Yeah, she does. Yeah, like she's in my head. I'll be out in the world looking at something and I'll hear her, how Jade would see it, you know, if that makes sense, which is, I'm sure that'll fade away as I write more and more characters. But at the moment, you know, with Angel coming out right now, it's definitely a part of my perception, you know.
The rich people and the and the colonizers of Proof Rock, talk about creating the gentrifiers.
Yeah, no, that was really fun, and you know, I didn't even realize it till just now, but it's the same thing I did in Zombie Bake Off, which is a novel about soccer moms versus zombie pro wrestlers. And in Proof Rock, the zombie pro wrestlers are the founders, the rich people, the Terra Novans. But what I wanted to do, it's way too easy to like vilify the 1%, you know? That's what Jade's knee-jerk impulse is. She's like, y'all have got money, y'all are, you know, colonizing our land, you're the bad guy, and they are doing bad stuff. But they actually, as it's revealed in Reaper anyways, a little bit in Chainsaw, these founders, these Terra Novans, yes, their money causes all kinds of problems, their money and their influence, but they don't actually have evil intentions. They think they're doing good, you know, which is always the problem with colonization, that people think if we bring religion to these savages, it's going to fix them. But that, you know, it's they do it for good reasons, but it's very destructive, you know.
Well, everybody sees themselves as a hero until somebody points out that they're actually, you know, Rick, you're kind of the villain in this story. Oh, really? Me? A plot in this story is really, really complicated, and it's really, really interesting. And I love the way it's written in a way like a super complicated British mystery. This reminds me in some ways of some of the work of P.D. James or Ruth Rendell, if they were, well-schooled in slashers. And so I'd like you to talk about, you know, using those kind of almost classic mystery formats to you know, put the pedal to the heavy metal.
Yeah, like who's that? What's that detective crime writer's name? Is it Ross McDonald? Yeah, like that guy. His plots are so like you can't guess what's going on, you know, and because he's just a brain on legs, it feels like, and he's really talented on the page. Reading his books, I think right before I wrote Angel, actually, I had read one of his novels. And I think it was very much in my head that, oh, you can be super complicated, but still have a narrative thrust, you know? And I love reading that kind of stuff. That's some of my favorite stuff to read.
Well, you actually write it too, because one of the things that as a reader, as I'm reading these books, I'm thinking, I can just barely keep in my brain all the parts of this. And then you're going forward and you give us like the the investigations do a great job of kind of like backfilling, you know, stuff we don't understand or maybe didn't quite understand. Talk about like that kind of juggling act as a writer of what we are supposed to know and what you're going to reveal and what you know you're going to reveal and what you discover you're going to reveal.
And, you know, a third way is probably the way it goes most of the time. I discover it in the doing. This is what I'm going to reveal. But you're right. The Baker Solutions investigative reports do offer like a different facet onto this scene, this person, this town, this community, this situation. And that was really fun for me because with Jade's first person narration, like she's not going to dwell on how she tried to save Camp Blood by chaining herself to a cabin, but doing it on Easter Day when nobody's there. You know, that's kind of embarrassing. But the Baker Solutions sessions can talk about that. They can like send her up like that. And that was probably my favorite thing about those investigative reports was these like contrasting views that we get through them of Jade. You know, I mean, it is, and we also get some exposition on Jade that we wouldn't have otherwise. It's just stuff that in a first person narrative, you're not going to talk about, you know?
Back in the late 1970s, I was a fan of many progressive rock bands, and one of my favorites was one called Hawkwind. And Hawkwind, an early member of Hawkwind decided it was a little bit too heavy metal for them, and his name was Lemmy. And you give us a Lemmy in this book, and he is a fantastic character. I just had a hell of a good time with that guy. So talk about creating Lemmy.
Now, Lemmy just totally surprised me when I named him that when he was 10 years old and my heart is a chainsaw. I just did it as a joke, you know. I just needed a placeholder name. But, well, I mean, I did it as a joke, but I also did it because I was using one of my friend, Ted Van Alst. His name is Theo. I was using his name for Theo Mondragon. And I know that that Ted is a really big fan of Motorhead. And so to kind of say thanks to Ted, I named this little kid Lemmy. And I thought that was where it was going to end, you know. But then lo and behold, in Angel of Indian Lake, Lemmy is back and he has grown up. And yeah, he has grown into a really interesting big kid. You know, he's really smart and he's funny, but not in the right way, you know. And he's just really fascinated with his drones. He likes his toys, you know? But I like looking at Lemmy because he's, of course, inhabiting the real Lemmy's like look and ethos, or he's kind of, I say inhabiting, he's definitely portraying it anyways, or play acting it, you know?
One of the things that is really making a change to the mystery genre and the horror genre and all genre is the ubiquity of good cameras and surveillance. I mean, right around the time the Berlin Wall fell and cell phones were introduced, it kind of like changed all of, especially mystery fiction, because once the cell phone's there, you can call somebody and say, hey, get the hell out of the house, the monster's coming. Now we have to deal with the fact that there's surveillance everywhere. Talk about how that influences your writing.
It definitely, you're right. So many novels and movies I see intentionally set themselves in like 1985 so they don't have to deal with all the surveillance and the cell phone technology, you know. But I prefer Scream's method, where cell phones are part of it, you know. They are built into the story. Without cell phones, it's hard to make that story work, I feel like, and definitely as it goes on, especially in number four, cell phones are really important in number four. And the surveillance, you're never like as alone as you think you are, you know. You know, like if you're going to lie to somebody, I wasn't standing on that corner, you better be sure there wasn't a camera at that corner. And that does change everything. And I think that as writers, a whole like generation of writers are dealing with that. You know, how does this complicate the story, and what is your response? You know, and I think it's making storytelling better. But it's like a hump you have to get over too, you know?
Having completed this big project, was anything else boiling in your brain while you were writing these other three books? And, I mean, how do you decide on land on what becomes a book or what becomes a short story?
Yeah, that's a good question. You know, it's, to me, it's just the scope of the idea, basically. Like with Indian Lake, I knew that that was a big sprawling story. However, I told it was going to be not small. I had tried to tell it small once before in a story called Raphael from 2006 in Cemetery Dance, I think. But even at that point when I wrote, I'm like, this is so much bigger. This is not fit in 25 pages or however long that story is. And yeah, I had other stuff cooking in my head while I was writing these books for sure. I guess the biggest one cooking in my head was I Was a Teenage Slasher, which is coming out in July. You know, that was, but it like, and also I have another one that would get cooked up while I was think, well, I say while I was writing these, it's really while Jade was doing her, you know, slasher diegesis that she's always locked in, you know, and while she was doing that, I thought of another slasher story I want to tell, and I'll hopefully get around to that in the next year or so, you know?
So, this book that's coming out in July, I Was a Teenage Slasher. What do we know about it, or what can we know about it?
Yeah, it's set in 1989. It's not to avoid cell phones, though. It's because 1989 is about when I left West Texas. And so I was kind of afraid that if I wrote West Texas, it's set in La Mesa, Texas, which is right next door to where I grew up. I was a little bit afraid that if I tried to do 1995 West Texas, it might be a little bit less authentic because I was gone by that point, you know? It's set in small town West Texas, and it's definitely, it's 100% a slasher, but it's a slasher of a kind that we haven't seen before. The closest analog would probably be Behind the Mask, Leslie Vernon, that story, that movie. But that's only like 30% of this novel. I feel like it's, as far as I know, it's doing something that I have not seen before. And it was really so much fun to tell. And I just actually just this morning finished my last pass across it, just doing little adjustments to this and that, you know, and I'm so happy to be sharing it with people, you know, not just slasher fans. I think this one will speak to a lot of people. And the rule I gave myself for it was, whereas the Indian Lake trilogy drops titles like breadcrumbs, like everywhere, this one could drop not a single slasher title. That was my rule. It couldn't name check any movie at all.
Well, I hope to be speaking with you in July about yep. I Was a Teenage Slasher. Thank you for joining me. Stephen Graham Jones, his new novel is The Angel of Indian Lake. Thank you for joining me.
Man, this was great. Thanks for having me. Great talking.
You're listening to the Agony Column News Report, featuring interviews, phone interviews, reports from live book events and festivals, and conversations with readers. You can find additional news, interviews, book reviews, and more 5 days a week at the Agony Column website at trashotron.com/agony.